ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument is Fogel v. Gordon & Glickson. Mr. Grotefeld.
May it please the court. Good morning, Judge Kane, Judge Posner, Judge Williams. My name is Mark Grotefeld, and I'm counsel for Richard Fogel, who is the plaintiff appellant and cross-appellee in this cause of action. This case arrived before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals at the district court as the district court dismissed the plaintiff appellant's cause of action for failure to state a claim based upon fraud. The appeal was timely filed. This court issued a rule to show cause as to why that appeal should not be stayed pending additional matter, and an amended judgment was entered before the court, barring the plaintiff an opportunity to proceed forward on an arbitration proceeding, and also denying the defendant cross-appellees or appellants in this situation Rule 11 sanctions petition. So therefore, we are before this court properly. The nature of this case involves a certain scenario facts. At the time of Gordon & Glickson, a law firm's reorganization in April of 1999, the firm created operational documents, two of which, one governing the affairs of the professional corporation, which was the existing corporation, and one governing the affairs of the limited liability corporation, the successor entity. Those two documents conveyed how the law firm was to provide deferred compensation to departing employees. When Mr. Fogel, an employee and a member of the firm, departed the firm in January of 2000, the firm had made a determination that it owed him approximately $462,000 in total deferred compensation, a part of which coming from the PC, a part of which coming from the LLC.
And is your fraud claim based on Fogel being induced not to take action to secure his interest in the PC investments or just on being induced to remain a creditor?
No, Your Honor, it's just on the PC. Fogel was induced to not take action on the PC's payout of certain amounts of money to the existing members of the firm. Roughly $1 million was paid out as stock that was held in a investment pool was provided to members of the firm. Mr. Fogel, while he was told that this action was going to take place, was never told that his interest of that $1 million, in other words, that these funds, that the accessible funds to pay what was owed to him, were going to be depleted from the asset. His portion, that's what we're talking about here, not their portion. The PC communicated to Fogel that it owed him a roughly $350,000, and of this amount, Mr. Fogel had been paid approximately $96,000, when, for the first time, he was informed no more money was coming to him based upon what they agreed was going to be owed to him.
And why didn't he file or assert a breach of contract claim for deferred compensation due under the PC plan?
Well, under the PC plan, Your Honor, it was a fraud. That's why. And that's why the case was pled as a fraud. The actions that were taken by the PC and the LLC, because we used documents from both corporations
that came to him. Can't arbitrators decide a fraud issue?
Certainly.
What did the arbitration clause say?
The arbitration clause in the plan called for any disputes arising over the amount owed would be subject to arbitration.
Well, there certainly was a dispute over the amount owed.
Actually not, Your Honor, in a sense that the amount was never in controversy. The amount owed was clear. As a matter of fact, it was set by Gordon & Glickson, the law firm itself. The PC, the LLC...
It was owed, and then it was, according to you, was defrauded. So that was certainly a dispute over the amount, whether it was zero or $250,000 or whatever.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree on that point because I believe sincerely that the amount owed was never in doubt. What was in doubt is why he was never paid that sum. And the allegations of the complaint brought in the federal court stated...
Well, what is the exact language of the arbitration clause?
The arbitration clause that relates to this specific element states that it's a question of whether...
Where is it? What is the exact language?
The exact language of the plan itself, Your Honor,
the
pertaining to...
The arbitration clause. What does it say? Exactly. Is it somewhere in these papers?
Yes, the arbitration clause is contained within the PC plan and the LLC operating agreement and plan. They have separate agreements, but they both contain an arbitration provision. Those arbitration provisions do say that, in fact, questions arising out of the amount owed are to be determined in an arbitration proceeding. What's germane here, Your Honor, perhaps is not so much whether or not the fraud claim could have or should have been brought in an arbitration proceeding, because quite frankly that issue was never even addressed at the trial court level.
Well, it could have been. Then you're splitting your claim. That's
Well, no, absolutely not, and here's why. Because with respect to the Limited Liability Corporation and the amount that it owed, it had paid Mr. Fogel 8 of the 12 payments it owed him. It only stopped paying Mr. Fogel once he filed his fraud case in federal court. So if we go to the question of from an arbitration proceeding...
Yeah, but you refiled it later, right?
Sorry?
It was dismissed and then you refiled it?
Refiled what, Your Honor?
Your fraud claim?
Correct.
And by the time you refiled it... the LLC had stopped paying.
Correct.
So at that point, you knew there was a breach of contract.
Correct.
So you could have filed, so when you refiled your fraud claim, you could have added a breach of contract claim.
Yes or no, because I think in this particular instance, I believe it was more appropriate to file the arbitration proceeding.
I understand the point of having such closely related claims litigated separately in two forms.
I don't believe they are closely related claims, and here's why. The fraud claim arose out of a series
related?
Of actions that took place with respect to dealing with Mr. Fogel in the year of 2000-2001. The breach of contract claim, as the case law provides, you look at Doe versus Allied Chemical and other cases along that same standpoint, you can have a same basic situation where somebody is leaving a firm, however, or underlying set of factors, but the transaction which gave rise to the breach of contract claim occurred only when Mr. Fogel filed his federal cause of action. That triggered the breach of contract, because it was in retaliation for his filing the fraud action. That is when they stopped paying Mr. Fogel from the LLC's coffers. So therefore, when the fraud case was filed in federal court, there was no triggering event, so to speak, that it occurred.
When you refiled your fraud claim, the breach of contract, as you say, you're calling it retaliation for the filing of the fraud claim. So why isn't it the same ball of wax?
Because the transaction that gave rise to the fraud claim was separate and distinct than the transaction that gave rise to the breach of contract.
Well, it was in January of 2000 that you say the fraud claim arose, correct?
The fraud claim arose
when the firm allegedly made these false representations and assurances that he would receive full compensation under the PC plan.
It wasn't specifically in January, Judge Williams. It was over the course of certain events that took place, certainly in 2000, January, February, March, the early part of 2000, but not specifically limited to. I don't want to limit it in scope of January of 2000. But in terms of the breach of contract action, that didn't take place until this lawsuit in the federal court was filed on the fraud claim.
Well, wouldn't the breach of contract claim have arisen in March of 2003 when the firm missed the first payment of monies due under the LLC agreement?
Well, under the LLC agreement, Your Honor, there was certainly an opportunity to proceed forward, but there are certain steps that you had to take, in other words, to find out whether or not payment was going to be made, et cetera. Inquiries were made of the firm as to the reasons why there was the discontinuation of the monies owed by the LLC to Mr. Fogel. And once it was determined that those monies were not going to continue to be paid, the appropriate context in terms of this aspect of the situation was within an arbitration forum. And as this court has said time and time again, it's best to take some elements of cases, if they can be, and put them in an arbitration scenario.
No, it isn't.
Pardon?
It's nice if you can shovel the whole case into arbitration, have pieces in arbitration and pieces in the district court. Very awkward.
They were totally different circumstances
also,
and totally different facts.
No, they're not totally different. That's ridiculous. What I don't understand. What do you think is the fraudulent representation that was made to your client?
The fraudulent representation that was made to Mr. Fogel was that he would be paid a sum certain out of the PC's assets based upon operating documents of the law firm and in a manner and method in which the law firm pays pays people departing from a firm. There was a certain pool of assets available for that, but the only chargeable asset, the only real asset that wasn't a paper asset, so to speak, was a certain amount of stock in Diamond Technologies. Mr. Fogel relied upon the fact that they were going to pay him this money. He relied upon the fact that they were going to pay him according to the plan.
Well, I thought the problem was that the value of this stock fell. If the value hadn't fallen, wouldn't he have done better?
No, actually, the Diamond Technology stock, Your Honor, is not subject to that valuation scenario. What I believe the defendants are suggesting, and again, we're talking about factual allegations here, not pleading a case, but we're talking about aspects of the facts of the case. Certainly, they can raise that as a defense. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about right now on a 12B6 scenario, have we pled facts sufficient to state a cause of action for fraud? And yes, we have. Mr. Fogel reasonably relied on what the law firm told him with respect to amounts that would be paid to him, how they would be paid to him, and what have you.
He was a party to this plan, didn't he?
Mr. Fogel was certainly a party to the plan, but once he left the law firm, he certainly did not share the same or equal information that the existing members of
the firm. And what is the information they had that they didn't disclose to him?
The information that they had that they did not disclose to him is that when they sold the Diamond Technology stock, they failed to keep his portion of that, in other words, to cover the amount that they owed him, in reserve. As a general creditor of the law firm, the members of the firm couldn't just take for themselves, stuff their own pockets with the money, and then tell him, gee, too bad, the PC doesn't have any more assets, when they knew that he was relying upon how the plan said monies were to be paid out. If they had told Mr. Fogel, you know what, we're going to take that $1 million, we're going to put it in our pockets, he then could have stood up and said, I disagree with that, and I'm going to take action. They didn't tell him that. And as a result, the absence of telling him that was the fraud, because they clearly knew that at the time that took place, the chargeable assets to the firm, as we have alleged, were nil. The only assets that could pay his claim at that point were the Diamond Technology stocks, and that's what we have alleged.
And at the time of his agreement, they knew that they were going to sell the Diamond Technology stocks. Is that part of your complaint?
Say that. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did they know at the time he entered into this agreement with them that he said he would accept the deferred compensation, that the Diamond Technology stock sale was being contemplated, or that they were going to use the whole $1 million?
We don't know that right now, but that's not important for purposes of this analysis. In the case of Williams versus Chicago Osteopathic Health, that issue came out in an Illinois appellate court. And there the Illinois appellate court stated a party who makes a statement, which at the time is true, but who subsequently gains knowledge that it makes it untrue or misleading, must disclose such information to anyone he knows to be acting on the basis of the original statement or is guilty of fraud.
So your position is he should have been notified. Fogel should have been notified when they were contemplating this.
Clearly, openly, completely, so that he could have made an informed decision, because his reliance was detrimental to him in that he sustained damages of $252,000 that he had no ability to recover from the PC because it was now an empty shell.
Could you address just briefly the fact that you didn't file a second notice of appeal with regarding to the injunction portion of the amended?
Yes, Your Honor. When going to that issue, Judge Kane, this court has jurisdiction to consider the arbitration issue because the notice of appeal is sufficient to confer jurisdiction over the amended judgment. Looking at the Allen versus Transamerica insurance case, we believe that is controlling here. A timely notice of appeal was filed. The appellate court in that case, as in this case, issued an order to show cause as to whether or not the order appealed from may or may not be an appealable judgment. An amended order was entered, and a briefing schedule was thereafter set by the appellate court. Same thing here. The three cases cited by the defendant appellee in this particular suggestion that they suggest there was not a proper appeal notice filed do not have that critical element in them, and that is, in those cases, there is no appellate court issuance of an order to show cause. I believe my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Rutkoff.
Thank you.
Mr. Rutkoff?
Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Posner, in response to a question that you asked, the arbitration clause is set forth at page 12 of the appellee's brief in footnote 6. It's a very broad arbitration clause and is not limited to the amount. Judge Kaney, in response to the question that you just asked, this is a case in which they are seeking to appeal from an order that was entered after the notice of appeal was filed. There is no case in this court, and I don't believe there's any case anywhere, that holds that a notice of appeal is effective going forward to orders to be entered. Now, with respect to the fraud claim, there is no fraud here. Mr. Fogel had, and he's attached to his complaint, and in fact attached to the plan document itself, was an inventory of the assets that were subject to this pool. Counsel said that the only asset that was chargeable was his stock in Diamond Technologies. Diamond Technologies was a substantial holding of the pool, but there was another holding called New Era of Networks, Inc., another publicly traded stock. At the time that the Diamond stock was sold, he had noticed that they were going to do that. At the time that the proceeds were distributed, they were holding approximately $1.6 million in options that were in the money. All or substantially all, that $1.6 million was in the money and was available as an asset of the PC. Now, counsel has said repeatedly and in several different ways that he had an interest in these funds. He failed to keep his position or his assets in reserve. There simply is no such requirement. To the contrary, under the plan documents, it says that once he leaves, he's no longer a participant in the plan, but he's a general creditor of the PC. General creditor has no right to require that the PC hold any assets in reserve for him. And had he known that the money was going to be distributed, and had he tried to protect himself, there's nothing that he could have done because there was no operative document. The documents themselves show that he had no right to require that any money be held in reserve. If he thought he had some right as a creditor, he should have asserted that. As Judge Williams, as you pointed out, if he thought he had a claim for breach of contract, he could have asserted that. There was no fraud here. Now, the response that they have made belatedly in their reply brief is that the holdings of the PC and the NEON, or New Era of Networks, Inc. In the reply brief, what they say is that that was worthless. And the reason they say it was worthless is not because it didn't have a market value, but they say it was worthless because the legal ownership was in Mark Gordon, who is a member of the PC. Well, that fact is disclosed on page 121 of Appellant's Appendix, the inventory of assets that he had, number one. So that fact was known to him. Number two, that theory of fraud liability was never alleged in any pleading. This is something that just surfaced in the reply brief here on appeal. And number three, the reason that there was no money left to pay him has nothing to do with the fact that the legal ownership was in the name of Mark Gordon. Mark Gordon did not run off and abscond with these assets. There is no allegation of that, and it didn't happen. The reason there was no money was because in the assets that were worth $1.6 million, as we all know, in March 2000, coincidentally, is a time when stocks and technology started becoming worth a lot less than they had been for many years before. In fact, In March, if the public records, which were appropriately attached to the motion to dismiss papers, the stock trading table show that during the first 3 months of that year, NEON stock continued to go up. He decided to stay in. He made an investment decision for whatever reason that he was going to remain as a creditor. And we all know what happened to stocks and technology. Mark Gordon was still there when the payments were due. The value in NEON was not there when the payments were due. That was something that could not have been predicted in March of 2000.
Is that the reason that the payments were stopped?
Yes. He received, Mr. Fogel, payments were made as long as there were assets. There were, but the $1.6 million had diminished in value and it was worth less than what he was owed. There were no distributions to anyone else, with the possible exception of a reserve that was held for another partner who had departed, which is shown on the papers.
And then there's no dispute in terms of the amount. In other words, that there were four more payments of ownership interest and deferred compensation under the LLC agreement that were owed to him.
Under the LLC agreement, there was no dispute as to, well, there was initially there was no dispute as to the amount. There would have been an issue, and there is an issue, as to whether he maintained his entitlement to that amount as a result of acts that the firm would claim breached the arrangements with him. But at the outset, going into this, it was a liquidated and known amount.
And one final question related to this. Haven't the parties consistently treated payments due under the PC plan as separate from payments due under the LLC agreement? Because we have two separate agreements that give rise to two sets of rights, don't we?
Yes. It is clear that they have looked to satisfy those payments out of the assets remaining in the PC. The PC payments have been made out of PC assets. The LLC payments have been made out of LLC assets. However, the operative agreements that are under dispute here are identical. The arbitration clauses are identical. They were signed at the same time to preserve the separate identity of the two entities. But there's no question that the parties had intended that each of them would maintain an interest in the PC and a separate interest in the LLC going forward. And it was, in fact, one integrated transaction documented with two sets of documents to reflect the fact that they were going to operate in the future as an LLC, whereas previously they had operated as a PC.
What was his incentive to remain a creditor rather than take his money initially? Because as a creditor, he wouldn't participate in an increased value of the stock, would he?
Once he left the firm, his value was fixed.
Right.
His incentive, I don't know what his incentive was, Your Honor. Actually, an opportunity was extended to him by the firm that was not available to him under the documents. Specifically, the firm said, you've just left. We've had this opportunity. The client has given us this opportunity to liquidate our investment. We're going to make a distribution. Do you want to participate? The downside, the disincentive to accepting that offer was that in terms of future payments, the amount would no longer be guaranteed. He would be subject to fluctuations. His entitlement would
no longer be fixed.
That's
the downside. What's the upside?
Of remaining in?
Yeah.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Why did the firm convert from a PC to an LLC?
That's not in the record. I believe it was solely tax-driven issues. And these assets, as you said, he was a party to the agreement when the conversion was made. The assets held by the PC, whether or not he claims to have known it or not, their correspondence in there indicates, and I think he alleged that they had to make the distribution or they wanted to make the distribution in advance of the tax payments. But if the PC had not distributed the proceeds, there would have been a double taxation because it would have been, if it wasn't dividended out, the PC would have paid income tax and then the shareholders would have paid tax on the compensation.
But wasn't he urged to remain in?
He was not urged to remain in. He was given the opportunity to remain in.
Yes. No. I mean, that's I don't object to that restatement of it. But But if there was no upside to him, what would be the basis for giving him the opportunity?
The reason that they gave him the opportunity? I think they thought they liked him. I think they thought it was a fair thing to do because he had, as
but
I said...
what was the benefit to him?
Well, because he would get an immediate payment. The payments were not to become due for another year, and then they were paid out over time. Here he had the opportunity to receive a big chunk of money right up front.
Oh, and I see. But it was just receiving the money earlier, not receiving more money.
No. He had the possibility of receiving more money.
How the possibility?
Because they said to him, we're going to sell this stock. If you want to participate in the proceeds, you can come back in and we will treat you for purposes of the plan as if you were a continuing member of the PC.
Even though he was actually just a creditor, is that what you're saying?
Yes, they would convert his interest. I don't know how it would have been documented, but the idea was that they would treat him as an ongoing member of the PC so that he had the potential to share if that Neon stock, the stock that wasn't liquidated, if that continued to rise, as they all expected, he would have shared in the value of that.
What was the size of the firm? How many lawyers?
Approximately 15 to 20 lawyers at that time.
In terms of the breach of contract claim, do you agree that claim really arose after the payment stopped? That were due under the LLC agreement in March 2003?
The LLC? Well, he never asserted, as you know, a breach of contract claim. The basis that he alleged, which could have been the facts that could have been used as the basis for a breach of contract claim against the LLC arose after he withdrew, but he amended his complaint and had the opportunity to assert that in the district court, but chose not to do so, thereby splitting his cause of action. And the argument that, first of all the arguments on this issue really are beside the point if he did not timely file a notice of appeal, which we believe to be the case. But the principal argument, as I understand it, for him filing the arbitration is that there was he was required to do so under the agreements. Well, he was also required to arbitrate his fraud claim, chose not to do so, and then came back and split both the causes of action. We have also asked the court to consider the district court's refusal to award sanctions under Rule 11 and Section 1927. This is a case where not only did the complaint self-destruct, but all of the documents, all of the facts about what assets they had, what their value was, what the terms of the plan were, they're all in the documents that they attached to their own complaint. And rather than bringing a breach of contract claim or asserting some creditor rights, they chose to assert a fraud claim against a group of lawyers without any basis whatsoever. This is not a case where we're on the cutting edge of the law or we're looking backwards in hindsight and saying that they should have known or should have foreseen something that came out in discovery. There was no discovery here. There was no need for discovery here. All of the facts were self-contained, and by any measure, they don't add up to a complaint. There was no fraud. Unless there are any questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Mr. Redkoff.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Grotefeld, your time expired, but you can have a minute if you want to say anything further.
Thank you, Judge Posner. The only thing that I really want to bring up at this point were two points that counsel just made. First of all, as to the Rule 11 issue, I really don't even want to address it. We're going to address that in the brief, so I don't really need to. We have addressed that in the brief. I don't think the court has abused her discretion in ruling on that issue. Secondly, as Judge Williams pointed out, from the arbitration standpoint proceeding, and as counsel even alluded to, there were things that happened after the fraud case were filed that were in the minds of these lawyers at this law firm that created a circumstance where they then made a decision to not pay him additional money on the arbitration.
Do you want to say something about the wording of the arbitration clause?
The wording of the arbitration clause? No, Your Honor, I don't.
Well, you said to me in your opening argument that it was limited to disputes over the amount.
I said, Your Honor, that the arbitration clause from that standpoint from the standpoint of the amount. If there was a dispute as to what the amount was that was owed.
You said the arbitration clause was limited to disputes over amount.
I didn't mean it if I said that.
You said that.
Okay, if I said that, Your Honor,
That was a complete misrepresentation of what the clause says.
Your Honor, I don't believe, again, if I said that it's simply limited to it, I misspoke.
You said it repeatedly.
Well, what I meant was, Your Honor, was that the arbitration clause includes a provision, and I thought I said this, but I apologize if I misled the court, that the arbitration clause contains a provision which provides for determining through arbitration when there is a dispute over the amount.
There is nothing in the arbitration clause of that sort.
Well,
it says if any dispute, claim, question, or disagreement shall arise as a result of or in connection with this agreement, the breach thereof, which cannot be resolved among the parties to the dispute, then at the request of any such party, the dispute shall be resolved through arbitration. Now, that certainly covers the fraud.
It could.
What do you mean it could? It does. It's a dispute. That's certainly a dispute as a result of or in connection with the agreement.
Your Honor, I don't disagree with you. I'm sorry, but I'm not disagreeing with you. What I'm saying is, from the standpoint of filing the fraud case in federal court, the only question that we're before this court on the fraud case is whether or not we pled a cause of action, not whether or not we were in the right forum, because the defendants never raised any objection to the forum. I think my time is up.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument is